You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This is a podcast from ComediansComedian.com.
This is the Comedians Comedian Podcast.
Hello and welcome to the show, and it's the first of our Edinburgh live recordings here from the Edinburgh Fringe 2015. This is Catherine Ryan. Thank you. Even by my low standards, Catherine, this is ridiculous. And people sitting near the front will see that when going for an emergency last glug of water, I actually dipped my nose in the glass. So
that's allowed.
I'm looking forward to you bringing some, I don't know what, class, professionalism?
I mean, positivity. I'm really pumped up already because I just took a bite of the world's most delicious ginger biscuit. If you haven't got a ginger biscuit, hook yourself up with a ginger biscuit.
This is Catherine Ryan very professionally getting the local audience on side. Tell us how you're doing. Tell us how the run is. I saw your show the other night. I saw one of your extra shows because you've done that magical thing at Edinburgh of coming up here, selling out your run kind of straight away.
Yeah. I mean, it's really prickish to be like, yeah, sold out, mate. You can't make it. You could come because there are returns sometimes. Word gets around, you know, that I'm a nasty woman. And sometimes the stand is too much of a walk for people. They don't turn up.
Yes.
And I'll tell you who doesn't mess around. Stand 3, and they'll sell those tickets. Yeah.
Explain what you mean. I'm sorry. I'm slightly lost.
Well, if you don't turn up, or if you return your tickets, they're really happy to sell them on. So there are people, and this is true, I think, with a lot of Edinburgh Fringe Festival shows. If you turn up 30 minutes before the gig, often they'll release production tickets or returns. I've been able to see loads of things that way.
Very nice. My hot tip is to go to things on your own. Is that a hot tip? I don't know. But I find you get in, you wander through, and you go, oh, look, there's a seat. Oh, look, there's a oneer down the front because everyone likes sitting apart from each other.
The cinema, prom.
My first question really was about to go, you seem very positive for someone who on stage I've seen tear celebrities new assholes in the vernacular.
New bleached assholes. Yeah.
So let's start with how it's going down. How are you being received here? Do you find you're getting walkouts from people who weren't expecting it, or does everyone know what to expect now when they come to a Catherine Ryan show?
You know, Stuart, that's really lovely because when you're starting out, you're always a surprise and sometimes a very unwelcome one. But now it's just that shift of people coming to see you on purpose. And that's lovely. Nobody walks out. A man fainted, but that's because some of the venues are really, really hot. And I was wearing a very revealing dress. No, I don't know. I just like people are really kind. And I think Jimmy Carr said really beautifully that offense is never given, it's taken. So why are you going to... I mean, I can't imagine someone to be, oh, no, not listening to this anymore and walking out. That's not going to happen. They don't come to see my show, those types of people.
Did it happen before you had more of a name for yourself? Did it happen when you were as part of a mixed bill? Were you? I mean, I think we should also explain. I'm sure everyone here knows you and is familiar with your work, but for anyone listening in the darkest corners of the world who hasn't heard of you, what kind of thing do you do, in your own words?
So for my mom and my dad, if they're listening, I ran away to become a comedian, and I live in England now. And my stuff, I mean, is sometimes very introspective. I talk about myself and the things I think, being a mom, being a single mom, dating, the type of terrible men that I like to date. But then I also, just like Joan Rivers did, I think, everyone's up for grabs. So you dig into yourself first, and then it's okay, and then you can go after celebrities. But you always beef up. You never punch down. So I wouldn't go after someone who is down on their luck or coming off a terrible scandal already. I hit people like Beyonce and Taylor Swift and Cheryl Cole.
Okay.
Those who can take it. And I don't like to talk about what a celebrity looks like necessarily, but more about the meta narrative, like the way they behave. It's kind of like a woman's magazine if a woman's magazine had words in it.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because obviously a criticism leveled at women's magazines and sort of, I don't know if that's, maybe other things as well, is that that you're putting the boot into people. Now, you, it's interesting, you've got that right and your eyes lit up for the benefit of the listener. I've got some boots, I put them in. So that's interesting, the idea of punching up, particularly when it's like when you say people who can take it. Now, obviously the Beyoncés and the Taylor Swifts of this world. I mean, is Cheryl Cole really on that sort of a level?
Yes,
Do you have a gradient? Have you written a great joke about someone in the past and thought, oh, actually, they're not having such a great time at the moment, I won't use it?
No, because I don't think that my jokes are ever cheap. I talk about behavior, so my problem with Cheryl Cole is that she maybe doesn't treat everyone very nicely. She's a bit of a diva. I'm just like E. No, you're not. You've been famous since you were 15. You're nothing like me. Also, I think that it's interesting. I'm talking about us as a nation. We got over her horrendous racist assault charge just because she's pretty. She's pretty. Oh, gorgeous. Absolutely gorgeous. So it's fine. And I that's more a statement about the forensic kind of type of celebrity digging that I do, just the way that celebrity works, more than the celebrity, his or herself.
Okay. I'm sure it's occurred to you that you are on a very impressive trajectory at the moment, and if you're not already a celebrity, perhaps you will be one day soon. Are you concerned that you'll be entering the fray?
No, not at all, because I peaked in terms of celebrity status when I was maybe 10 years old. I was a big celebrity at my school, huge celebrity. Absolutely everyone hated me. I was like that dentist in America who killed the lion. I was like, I was that kind of celebrity. Cecil, R.I.P. Cecil. You know my views on Cecil the Lion? Again, relating it all back to fame, this dentist paid $55,000 to go to Zimbabwe and shoot a majestic lion for sport. And then when everybody got upset about that, his excuse was, I didn't know Cecil was famous. But yeah, that's why we're sad. So when American police accidentally shoot Beyonce, they're going to be like, oh, we had no idea this innocent young black woman was famous. We thought it was Michelle. I think, I don't know. I mean, I have this part of my makeup that's broken. I've never been hurt by any type of words or bullying, especially when it's well-written. I love the American Comedy Central roasts.
Yeah.
And I participated in one of those with Jeff Ross and this wonderful woman named Sarah Tiana, who does a lot of writing for Jeff Ross, and she's a comedian in her own. She's very, very talented. Jimmy Carr actually traveled there and won the whole thing. It was a roast off. He represented Britain very well and won, but she had terrible things to say about me. I loved it. I was smiling, listening. It's really fun. I mean, I'm not important enough to be precious. Like, oh, don't you make fun of me. Oh, I expect everyone in my hometown to love me so dearly. Of course they weren't going to like me. Of course they weren't. It didn't bother me then. It wouldn't bother me now. It's fun.
When you say that, how much truth is there in the idea that if you were, I mean, would you say you were bullied when you were 10 years old? When you say everyone hated you, would it take the form of bullying or just people talking about you behind your back?
I mean, I was better than them, so it wasn't bullying.
That's obviously, that's part of your stance, that's part of your persona.
Yeah.
And I am kind of fascinated by how much that's really the truth of you as a 10-year-old girl. You just went, hey, fine.
Okay, well, when I was older than 10, I was maybe 13, all the girls, and these are the real high school film girls that you see in the American movies, like the cheerleaders. Catherine, why can't you be normal like us? I was like, you bitches aren't normal, you're ordinary. But they would, they made a magazine, and this was very forward-thinking before Twitter and online bullying. They made a newspaper in my picture was on the cover next to a picture of a camel, and it said, "Thank God for makeup." And then it was written inside all these things about me and my little weird friends. We were alternative. And it really, all my friends cried, and I was always fine with it. And the principal of the school was really worried that I was fine with it. He thought I was planning, like, a school shooting. I was like... He was like, "It's really not okay, Catherine. Don't you want to cry? Aren't you sad?" And I just said, like, "No, it's tabloid journalism. It's pretty flattering, actually." I never cared. I never cared. Genuinely, I don't know why. Help me, Stuart.
Why do you... Well, okay, I'm interested. Everything you said there, obviously, is a performative situation, but the whole way you've described it there is from your show.
Yeah.
And those are written jokes about your show.
But
those
it's a true story.
Sure, absolutely.
The newspaper was called The Underground.
Okay, so it genuinely happened. And are we getting, I mean, we're getting absolutely a sense of you, how you have, you've gone through that situation, come out the other side, packaged it for the stage. And I'm not suggesting that any of it is a lie necessarily, but how much of it are we, how much of it can we assume is someone who is now full of confidence and defending herself? And actually defending herself in quite an aggressive way. But, you know, there's loads of funny jokes about what idiots those girls are.
Yeah, and they really are. But I think, yeah, you're right. The more times somebody says, I don't care, then it does bother them. I would be upset if my peers disliked me, if people that I respected actually didn't like a show that I did or didn't like me as a human being. I think I would find that really difficult to deal with. Luckily for me, I am adored unanimously. I think that would bother me. It would. But these people, I mean, you got to come to my hometown and see. It didn't bother me. And I don't know. I mean, the same as I do to celebrities. I don't tear apart their soul or their work. It'll be specific behaviors that I think that they would have a laugh about. And if someone did the same to me, I really can't see myself having a problem with it.
Can you? You must be able to. We're not going to spend the entire interview talking about this, but I think it's a fascinating facet of what you do. Seeing as you're, I mean, I've heard it described as like almost the genre of I'm an insult comic. I think of that kind of. I think of Joan Rivers or Bianca Del Rio from Drag Race.
Yeah,
or something, you know what I mean? Just bang, 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 just amazing. And I saw Bianca live in San Francisco, absolutely destroy the ballroom. It was amazing. And you're very much within that kind of category. Like, I feel like we could see you come on stage and you would just be able to just take out every single person in the room.
No, I wouldn't do that. I'm not an insult comic in that way. I think you can roast in a benevolent manner. And it's funny how that's never translated properly.
It doesn't work
to
in the UK, does it? No.
People feel really strange about it. Jimmy Carr did a roast in it. I thought it was brilliant, but I don't know what it is that Americans... Now, in my own personal experience, it's not that they're more sophisticated at all, but there's something about the roast language that they understand, and that's what I'm doing. So if people were to come to see my show and there were people that I hadn't met before, I had no frame of reference, I would never be like, your dress, your jacket, your watch, your wife. Never. I wouldn't do that. That's not fun for me. And from time to time, I've had a heckler, a very drunk, usually woman. Thanks, girls. They're the worst drunk people, but, it'd be really mean, just nasty, saying nothing. And if I've been in a bad mood, shooting that person down even makes me feel really sad.
Do you do it anyway?
No, I don't. I've done it once and I felt really terribly about it for about a week.
What were the circumstances? Do you remember what
she
you said?
Just really drunk. And she said something about, you're shit. Look at you. Look at you. You're shit. It's a fucking look at you. You can't come back to someone that drunk because they don't know when they're beaten. And I don't know where I went with it, but I was really mean to her. I flipped the bitch switch. And I wish I hadn't because that's not fun. It's not fun to hurt people.
Sorry, I thought you were going to say something else there. I wasn't deliberately leaving a dramatic pause. Is it? Think about it in your own lives. I'm interested in this idea of the roast because I wonder if. Part of the reason it works in the States is the world of celebrity in the States is full of this kind of falsehood, perhaps.
Oh, yeah.
Perhaps it's full of falsehood, and so people like it when you say the truth behind it, the thing that you say, the unsayable. Maybe in the UK, we're just used to saying the unsayable. We're just used to being mean to each other.
Maybe. I mean, it is a very saturated tabloid culture. There are more daily newspapers in the UK than there are in Canada and America combined. You have your own real system of celebrity. But I think what resonated with people maybe with my Cheryl Cole views is not just that I went after her, but I did it in a way that people maybe don't do. And if it's on the nose, if people agree, then you're fine. Like, it is really bad what she did to that toilet attendant. And it is true about us that we forgave her simply because she was cheated on by Ashley Cole and got fake teeth. Like, that was the whole reason we were all like, oh, that's fine then. And to point that out is actually really sophisticated, or at least I try to be. It's not just going slagging people off.
Sure.
I think that's what I try to do.
You have a real skill, I think, for finding like an inversion in someone's behavior, like finding the inverted. What's the parallel, the real life parallel of the celebrity situation?
I try to, yeah.
Like, I mean, as you said then, describing the girls, you know, you're not normal. Was it, you're not normal, you're ordinary.
Yeah.
Like, that's a beautifully written. So when you come to write something like that, and is that something that tumbles out of you, or is that something that you craft and you sit down and with a laptop or a pen and you try and find just the right word?
Yeah, I don't have a really good process. Do you sit down with a laptop and write?
I have done in the past. I do a bit. I hate it. I hate every second of it.
I want to do that more. I don't. I just walk and sometimes think about things and put them in my phone. But I'm really interested in media and celebrity and all the news anyway. So I see that. I'll have an opinion on it. And then it's about kind of crafting that later on. But usually I have to be on stage to do it. That's why I do open mics to figure that out. And the first time it's not funny at all. It'll just be an idea. But I wish I could sit. I know some comedians who wake up at 9 a.m. and put their clothes on and make a tea and have an office and just work. I'll do that for a panel show because you've really got to, as you know, watch all the news and prepare jokes and arguments about it. And that helps. But I wish I could do that all the time.
Do you find that there are particular particular systems that you rely on? Do you catch yourself doing, like, do you identify a kind of a Catherine Ryan take on a subject? What's a typical take on a subject for you?
Ooh, I don't know. What's a typical take? The right one.
Do you have that? Well, that's a different question, maybe. Do you have that performative confidence that you have now, whereby you're very high status, your status is very elevated, the joke is often that you're right and everyone else is wrong?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, do you...
Well, that's where my personal life comes in, because my personal life is a mess and I'm always wrong. And you have to be vulnerable and you have to be the biggest mark in your show to get away with the rest of the stuff. And I have no problem laying it all out and being very revealing and very... I mean, I talk about my own life. I point out my own mistakes. I think I pretty much roast myself better than anyone else.
And do you always do that? Do you notice a difference in, say, you have to do a 5-minute or a 3-minute spot for a TV thing?
Mm-hmm.
And do you have to make sure that you put in time to roast yourself before doing the Cheryl Cole routine? Or is that strong enough that the jokes work on their own?
You're right. Yeah, especially in Britain, I do think you have to be self-deprecating a little bit before you can go at someone else. Otherwise, you do just seem like a bitch. It's like, blah, blah. But again, I don't know, actually. If in a really short spot, if the jokes are smart enough, people can see that you're not just being cheap. And I've learned, because I used to say, I used to joke about my daughter's father and our split and how we don't like one another. And I only started to do that when we became friends again. So I really do like him now, and we are friends. And now it's fun to get all those jokes about what a terrible human being we are and how we're enemies. And what's fun about that is that he knows it's not true, and I know it's not true, and she will always grow up knowing that that's not true. But it makes me a little bit uncomfortable because people pick me up on that. They'll be like, oh, you can't talk about your child's father. You can if you're still married, but if you're divorced.
Yeah. That's interesting. That is.
Yeah.
That's a little, I mean, that's a very you approach, like spotting a hypocrisy in what you're told to do, in the way you're told to behave.
But Kirstie Alsop came after me about something, about saying that my daughter's father and I didn't get along. I said, we're not together anymore, but we are still really good friends, is a lie I tell to protect her. We are not good friends. And there's a lot of truth in that. As far as my daughter, who's 6 years old, knows, we're best friends. We don't row. We get on. It's perfect. But he's not someone that I would be, you know, after a split, it is what it is. You make the best of what you have. And she came after me on Twitter and was like, what a terrible woman, blah, blah. Kirstie Alsop is an interior decorator and who famously
That's
said...
That's not a euphemism, just in case you're not from you.
She did an article in a newspaper that got a lot of press, actually, and it was that women should delay their education and have babies younger. Mm-hmm. And that was very... I mean, I don't know, polarizing, polarizing. And so I felt badly. But then I thought, you know what? Had I stayed in school longer and not had my daughter so young, maybe I would still be with her dad. Great advice, Kirstie Alsop. Her comments are actually dangerous to young women. What I said wasn't dangerous. Like, stay out of my life, Kirstie Alsop. But I did feel a little bit. I think I've learned that, to answer your question, in a really long way around. I think that I've learned, if I feel a little bit uncomfortable about what I have said on stage, then I've done the right thing. I think that's the kind of comedy
Say that
I
again,
like.
Sorry. If you feel a bit uncomfortable, then you feel you've done the right thing.
Yeah, for me. Because the jokes that I love the best, I always feel a little bit scared about in the beginning. Am I going to get picked up on that? Am I going to get sued again? Am I going to get... And I just feel like, yeah, I've gotten comfortable with... That's the way it's meant to be for me, I think.
Tell us about... That when that has gone wrong, you say sued again. Is that the Philippines? Did was it the
yeah, actually,
Philippines suing you, or
can't
they just
get into that.
You? You can't. Okay.
So
that is the best way to not answer a question. Is on legal advice. That's fair.
I can do it like carefully. All that happened is so dumb. I was cheated on like a million times, but I only found out about the one time at the time, and I wrote a show a little bit about that. Not including any names or anything, but the wonderful man who cheated on me and was an all-around prick, really. He got upset that I was doing a show about being cheated on. It was my story. It was my like narrative. It wasn't about him, but he got really upset and threatened to sue me if I didn't keep quiet about having been cheated on. And I am not a woman who likes to be silenced. So that was weird. That was difficult for me because that's what you get when you cheat on a comedian. I'm sorry, I didn't talk about him personally, but you have to talk about your life. And that was about my interactions with this other woman and my failures and my poor judgment. That's what that was about. Okay. I'd do it again.
And you don't do that show anymore, so
no.
Have you ceased and desisted?
But I
believe I know the stuff, and I feel like I've seen it on YouTube.
Yeah, he didn't end up suing me, that
okay.
one. So I dodged jail for being cheated on. Oh, lucky me.
God. How did that make you feel? Compared you with the 10-year-old you being bullied and being made fun of and it all just gliding off you, is this sort of the injustice of that? Is that more of a bind? Is that presumed? I imagine that your reaction to it would be, now you write a show about being sued for writing
no,
a show.
No, he's dead. You can kill a person just by never talking about them again. Isn't that cool? You could just never look at them or talk to them. You block them on everything and all, and they die. So he's dead.
For the benefit of the listener, we may or may not be talking metaphorically.
You can't libel the dead. No, he's not in any show anymore. But I was lucky. It didn't make me sad when he had that reaction. It made me feel like, oh, great. Then I have definitely, definitely, definitely done the right thing by leaving you.
So this is the fantastic Catherine Ryan. I'm keeping this one short and sweet in terms of the blurbs from me in this episode. As you can probably hear, there's some background noise of one of those lovely little nooks in Edinburgh that you get off the main drag and find yourself in a lovely little green square where ball games are prohibited. Thank you so much for downloading the show. Catherine is just an incredible comic. She walks on stage and you just think, bang, star quality. She has got completely brilliant jokes. She's got an incredibly, as you'll hear, she's just absolutely on the nose when it comes to her use of language, when it comes to the targets whom she directs her jokes, the brevity of them, the leanness of the words that she uses, and she's just an absolute joy to watch. So I can't recommend tracking her down enough to try and see one of her live shows, and she's got bundles of stuff on YouTube as well. As I said, I'm going to keep this short and sweet as I parade around getting funny looks from people. This is not too dissimilar to me hanging around under a tree in Auckland. I think it was last year and a half ago. I forget the episode. Now, what will I tell you? The Edinburgh shows are going fantastically well. I'm very pleased to announce that my solo show, An Hour, has been nominated for the Amused Moose Comedy Awards. I'm not wholly certain of the title of that, but there's 10 of us, 10 finalists. Tomorrow we'll be doing a thing there that people can come and see. And then I believe it's one of those nebulous arrangements of like, it's partially an audience vote and partially some judges and partially a panel and partially some kind of incredible puppetry will be involved. But that's very nice. I mean, in very good company. People like Ian Smith and John Hastings and Jess Robinson and Richard Gadd, who I really recommend you track down Richard Gadd's show this year. I've only been able to see the last 15 minutes of it and it absolutely knocked my socks off. So when he comes to the Soho Theatre, as I'm sure he will, do remember to look out for Richard Gadd. And so great company to be in. Thank you very much. I don't believe I can ask you to vote for that. I think it all gets resolved before you'll hear this episode. But that's very pleased. I've had some nice reviews. More importantly, I've been really enjoying PBH's Free Fringe. I've been packing out the room at the Cannon's Gate. So if you're in town, you can come along at 4:55, although I would highly recommend getting there at 4:25 at the latest to ensure you get a little token. They're very tight on fire regs as well, they might be. So come along and see that at the Cannon's Gate pub on Canongate in Edinburgh. You can also come and see more of these live shows, of which Catherine Ryan is the first that we're releasing. So far, we've had Will Durst, John Lloyd, a terrific show with John Lloyd, an absolute mind-bender of a show with Tommy Tiernan, and then a really invigoratingly difficult one with Stuart Francis, who is a brilliant, brilliant comic and is completely, as you will hear when we release that in a few weeks, completely physically unable to not do his act, to not be funny. And he's got some very good reasons. I really pushed him on it, and it makes for a really, really, I think, a very fascinating episode. So plenty more of those to come. There's still a few left with, who have we got tonight? Mae Martin. And then we've got Joel Dommett, Daniel Sloss, Ronnie Cheng, Aisling Bee, loads more people. You can get the full lineup for Who's On When if you join the Comedians Comedian Facebook group Facebook group. So find out all that info or follow at ComComPod and you can email info@comedianscomedian.com if you'd like to send me a message with requests and suggestions for future guests. And of course, remember you can donate at comedianscomedian.com. You can click on the PayPal button, donate £5, £10, £20 or whatever you think this show is worth to you. We now have merch and I really nearly want to tell you I've got a great idea for a code system. So if you... The system is going to be, don't do it yet, the system is going to be, if you donate £22.22 to the PayPal account, then that will be a code and I will go, aha, this person wants a t-shirt and I shall send a t-shirt to you. And I think we'll work out something more specific with the 22. If it's 21, 22, 23, 24, then that will be a code for the size, right? Pretty great way of doing it without needing to faff around installing a merchandising client on the website. So... those are very, very nearly available. You can buy them in cash for £20 or £15, I think we're doing at the live shows at Black Medicine at 5 to 11 for the rest of the festival. So come along to those if you'd like to grab your merch. Also, the ComComPod laminates are available now. I'll put a picture of those on the website. Honestly, as soon as I get round to it, I'm going to go and eat some food now. And then I'm going to go do my show. Yeah, I hope you're enjoying it. I'm having a whale of a time at the festival. You'll remember from last week's spoken bit. I call it blurbs. Let's refer to it as the blurbs. You remember from last week's blurbs, I put far, far too much on my plate. And a lot of things have had to fall by the wayside. I've tried to see as much as I can so that I can be genned up when I interview some of the brilliant comedians that we've got here this year. And there is still one special mystery guest yet to be announced for the very final Comedians Comedian Live at Black Medicine at 5 to 11 on the final Saturday of the Fringe. That's all for now. Thank you very much for listening. Thanks, loads of you are coming out and seeing the live show. It's great to meet you. Thank you for coming, everyone that has. And I'm really proud of this year's show. I'm really, really super proud of it. I think I'm having the most fun Fringe ever. So thanks for being a part of it. Feel free to come and see one of the things. And it's the Free Fringe. Bring money, as I've become fond of saying at lineup shows that I'm directing people here. So that's all for now. Let's get back to the absolutely brilliant Catherine Ryan. So when you started comedy, when did you start in the UK?
No, I started in Canada in, I don't even know what year, maybe 2007. Yeah. And I had done a couple gigs. I wasn't a jobbing comic. I was doing open mics and I was waitressing and I was in uni and I was doing all these things. I just did comedy because I liked it. It was like a Zumba class. It was this thing for me that I liked to do.
In what way was it like? That's a lovely idea. In what way was it a Zumba class? Like, is it that it's expressive or that it's so scary you come out of it feeling invigorated? What kind of...
Yeah, that's good. All those things. I mean, it's invigorating, but it's also an exercise. It's something that you do to make yourself stronger. And you don't do a Zumba class to show off to everyone else. You're not going to pull it out at a dinner party or become like a Zumba teacher, maybe. But you just enjoy it. Everybody has hobbies. I just did it for myself because I was working in an environment where I couldn't always speak. I think having a voice is so important. And I've understood more about having a voice as a woman growing older and being a mom now. And a lot of women all around the world don't have a voice. And I think it really wound me up. There are always people telling me, don't say that. You can't say that. That's so weird. Don't say that. So stand-up comedy is so liberating. I love it.
I mean, is that you? Is that the voice of your childhood peers again, saying "Don't say that"? Or is that your parents? Or is that who inhabits that voice that you feel is telling you not to say something?
Everyone. I just always knew that if I riffed with anyone at any time, at Christmas, at school, at a family, it was met with the confusion. Like, why would she say that? What's she fucking saying? Yeah.
So how did you keep going? How did you keep riffing, being told over and over again that if the whole reaction of everyone around you?
Well, I didn't for a while. I really bottled it up, and I tried to be a cheerleader for a while, and then I worked at Hooters for a while, which is not a titty bar, but I know that when you don't have one, you think that, oh, Hooters, they know what it is in North America. It's a sports bar, beer and wings. And
sure.
Yeah. But I worked there, and I really genuinely thought the best thing that a young woman could be was pretty, to be a decoration, and I tried to play that role for a little while. It didn't last very long. But I found people all the time. You know, there's always going to be a little theater group in your town. Whatever town that is, you'll find your people. Whatever school you're at, you'll find your people. One of my sisters was really cool. The other one.
Yeah, well, I've seen the show.
Yeah. And then I went to uni, and I went to uni specifically. I was kind of like a – and I know that the experience of a closeted young gay person is very difficult and different to what mine was. But I was closeted in a way that – often their story is, I went to the big city to find people like me. These places filled with people who've never been anywhere in the world can be very stunted and closed-minded. And that I kind of had the same, and that's why a lot of my peer group are these gay men.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
And that I go out dancing with. We kind of have the same upbringing. And I hope I'm not marginalizing anyone by saying that, but that's how I felt.
But you sort of felt socially closeted.
Yeah.
So when you first struck out on stage, when you first... What was the moment when you first felt like yourself? Was it your very first gig, or was it, you know, a couple of years in or a couple of gigs in? When did you... Was there a moment when you remember going, ah, this is it, I'm out of the closet on stage?
Oh, no, I don't know. I think we have little victories every day. Little things will make you feel more like yourself. I don't know who I am yet. I'm 32 years old. That's too old to do anything in America. But here, I'm still allowed on television in the UK.
Yeah.
And I think a big milestone was having my daughter, because, and you can be a mother or a father, you don't have to be. But for me, it really gave me this sense of, oh, I don't matter at all. And that was great. That was a real awakening to myself. I can do what I like. I can make mistakes. I can get up. I can fall down. But as long as my child is healthy and well, then nothing else matters. Oh, it's hugely, hugely liberating becoming a mom, because you really don't matter anymore. You can't. Who is it? Sarah Kendall, a really talented Australian comedian who works a lot in the UK. She has this joke about having a great gig, or getting, you know, feeling a little bit important, and then saying, oh, you know, I'm really on to something here, and going home and having to, like, wipe her daughter's bum. And the daughter was like, give me that book. Pass me that book. And she said, I'm not your slave. And it's very difficult to convince someone that you're not their slave when you're wiping their ass. Yeah.
So let's talk about the – so just to stay with that – that first kind of gigging experience. You say you don't know who you are yet, almost like that process of finding your voice is still continuing.
Oh yeah, I mean, I'd be an idiot if I thought I was enlightened. Like, yep, I figured it out, Stu.
Sure, but you are enjoying a certain degree of success and huge sellout shows, and you have. I hate to use the word brand, but do you know what I mean? I think people go like, you may not feel like you have your voice, but people know who you are. They know who they're coming to see.
Yeah.
So that person, if it's not your voice, call it something else. But that person, did that start on day one? Did that arise on your first Edinburgh show? Did that arise on the first time you played a particular gig?
Yeah.
I know it's always a process of chipping away at it, but I just want to stay with this idea of the moment of coming out the closet. The moment of going, yeah, fine, this is it. This is what I'm supposed to be doing.
Oh, I don't, let me think. I'm not sure. I started doing stand-up in Canada. That was still like met with mixed reviews. And then the UK was one little epiphany where there were all kinds of different voices and you could be more authentic in your voice. I love that about the UK. People, you don't have to be one type of comedian. I found that in Canada, and again, I hate to speak about an industry that I'm not really in, but from what I could see in my own personal experience, it seemed like the best received comedian was in the checkered shirt with a beard, kind of a bigger guy who could tour all across in the prairies and everywhere else. I was not that. I was alternative to them. In the UK, I'm not alternative. That was cool. That was a bit of like, oh, this is okay. And there are all these women on the bill and all these sketch acts and different kinds of comics. And then a big moment was when I first did 8 out of 10 Cats with Jimmy Carr and Sean Locke and John Richardson, and that was May 2012. I was really, really scared because they are amazing headliner comedians that I've always looked up to. Hannibal Buress was over from America. He is great as well. Stephen Magan was on, and I thought, I can jump out the window or I can just do it the way I know because I can't beat them in their voice. I knew that if I went out there and tried to compete with Sean Locke, I wasn't going to do it because I'm not Sean Locke. And it was really a punt. I mean, I went out and I did material. I took football and made it about celebrities. And I took this, what, something else, The Voice, the show The Voice, and I made it a little bit rude. And I just did as loudly as I could, I mean, metaphorically loudly, my own voice. And I thought, this is it. This is how I do it. And it worked, but it could have gone the other way.
That's that you mentioned. I think that's fascinating, and I think that idea of authenticity,
yeah,
is something that I don't think I ever used to strive for. I had a sense of just kind of, I do what I do, and I suppose only recently am I kind of that's my latest thing is kind of going, no, don't just do what you do. Try and be real in what you do.
Yeah.
And how do you find that authenticity? How do you nurture that authenticity? Do you have moments when you find yourself? Do you ever feel on stage, the way I said that or the way I'm practicing this thing is inauthentic? Or do you now, are you so clear in kind of, this is how I feel about the subject that you can take a line through it?
Yeah, I don't think about that at all. I'm not a very complicated person. I kind of only have one way of looking at everything, and it's my voice all the time because it comes from me. So, no, I don't think about it.
And do you?
Am I supposed to? Oh, no.
No, you're absolutely not. Don't. We can't break, Catherine. That's the downside of this podcast. Yes, go away and think about this too much.
I wouldn't say something on stage that I didn't think is funny. And sometimes I say things on stage that no one else thinks are funny.
And do you still believe in them when you have, like, say a new bit? Like, what's the difference between you having your killer set that works, killer Club 20, whatever you're rocking at the time, you do that at a gig and it just doesn't go off. What's the difference between that feeling and you trying a new bit that you believe in that gets nothing?
I still like doing a new bit that gets nothing. I wouldn't do that somewhere that would disappoint a huge group of people
In Old Rope, in a kind of open spot thing. How many times do you try a bit before thinking, I've got to give this up, I just can't make it work?
Oh.
Or do you make it all work?
Yeah, maybe five times. If something really dies, I'll take it out. I'm trying to think about, there's a bit right now that doesn't really work that well. It's about how I have a superhero power of, I've dated a string of terrible men, put it that way. And it's about how that's going to continue because of how great my daughter is. I always celebrate my daughter. That's another thing. People go, do you worry about talking about her? There's no way that I could be anything but adoring. I love her so much that even when I talk about her and I take the piss, it's it's completely in her favor. I honor that child. But she's so great that I say, oh, yeah, and they see that I have this superpower. I can take the world's most garbage cum and turn it into a princess. like alchemy. And that's a bit rude for people. Also, again, they're like, well, that implicates her. But again, I don't care. I like her dad. I'm just kidding. I'm joking half the time. And I like that joke, but other people don't. And even in the room today, interesting, people are like, nope. But, yeah. Well, that happens.
Let's talk then about quality control. What sorts of things have you cut from this show and why?
Oh.
And maybe think back a few months, because the show is absolutely slick as anything now.
Well, that's
really
kind.
Yeah, I mean, you know, there's yeah.
Okay. Well, I talk a lot about being a mom, and there's all this, oh, why do you talk so much about being a Chinese man? Why do you talk so – because everywhere that Chinese man goes, when he goes to the shop and when he's in a relationship, he is a Chinese man. Like, that's his narrative. And so people,
just to clarify, Catherine doesn't talk about being a Chinese man. I just went, same
but
page.
I should do it more. Yeah, why do you talk so much about being a mom? Well, everything I do is kind of in the framework that I'm a mom all the time. But this show was meant to be a lot more about my little sister, who was my first baby, and she's getting married next month after the Fringe. So I really had to ditch a lot of the mom stuff and the things about my life now. There's still a parallel. I do talk about it, but it's more about where I come from and what I was like when I was that age in my family, in my town, and the little scandals that I've gotten myself into over the last year.
So is there... Like, do you work with a director ever? Do you structure your show entirely yourself? Does the order change on a night, or do you go, that's the script?
No, I do change the order. I had notes all over the stage on the first night a week ago. I was still kind of writing it. I don't have a director, and I didn't really know that people did, and now I'm hearing a lot about directors. But I don't know. And they do a great job, and I can see that it's great to have another set of ears and eyes on your show. That's cool. Maybe I'll try it one day. There's a man called Jeff Norcott who's really, yes, really talented. Yeah, he's got a show at the Tron at 2:20 every day, and that's free. Free with a bucket. And
free Fringe, bring money.
Yeah, he's wonderful. And he and I write together sometimes for panel shows. I'll get him in a room and we put our heads together and I'll be like, what do you think about this? And you just think, he's a right-wing comedian as well, and I'm not, and it's fun to have an extra kind of person on the case, especially when it's heavy news satire.
Yes,
we get together a lot and write.
So do you
but
get
not for stand-up,
given that he is so famously, or you know, like within the circuit, he's known to be conservative?
Yes.
Do you find that do you have political arguments between you about your differing points of view?
Nope.
I mean, by way of making material, I mean, I don't mean, do you ever put down your pens and go, oh, I can't cope with this. Yeah. But, you know, is there a tension between you politically so that you see things from different points of view? Or is politics completely by the by?
No, I think he thinks that David Cameron is as much of a prick as I think he is, but he just, he voted for him.
And when you're, there's a couple of different things I want to talk about. Maybe we could look at like a specific bit of material from this year's show, because I know people can still, maybe will have seen it this year or have the opportunity to still. Which bit of your show are you most proud of?
My favorite is the beginning, because I go straight into just topical celebrity stuff. And I do like to do that. That's, it is in a way related to my hometown, because it shows a departure from everything else that I talk about, what I've turned into and the stuff that I've always been drawn to. But I love that. I love just a slick, as few words as possible, monologue. Like, I grew up loving late night chat shows and watching Carson and David Letterman, yes, and stuff with my mom. I love that monologue.
It's very, I saw that and I thought, that's very TV ready.
Oh, I love that monologue. I love.
Why? What about it? Just is it, apart from the kind of the nostalgic element of that's what I grew up with, what is it that you think that's better or what? That was a terrible way to ask a question, but why is what I'm asking.
I think that it's challenging to look at the news and write about the news quickly and tight, and that's celebrity news for me a lot of the time, but it is also about the election and Bill Cosby and Oscar Pistorius, whatever, just whatever's going on in my Twitter feed. I love to read about that. I love when other comedians make jokes about that. It's just the way that I read the news now. I think it's the way a lot of people read the news. A lot of people find out about politics on The Daily Show.
Sure.
Not because they've read, you know, The Telegraph. Or
yes. Okay. So, something I've always thought would be, and I don't do any topical really. I'm not interested in celebrities. That doesn't, I mean, I know enough of the, like, I felt like I knew everything that you were talking about without really feeling like I engage with the process of celebrity at all. So I got the best of both worlds.
I have to write it for people like you.
Yeah, absolutely. You did a great job.
Yeah.
But as a writer, I would always think, how do you make sure that you, when something happens and then Twitter activates and everyone comes up with a fresh comic angle on it or several hundreds of, how do you make sure that your stuff, that you're coming up with an original angle, something that hasn't already been covered?
I think sometimes if I know that I'm going to do Mock the Week, for example, I won't look at Twitter for a few days. I'll just watch the news.
You have to kind of be separate from it
and then it's
so that you
pure.
Don't get stuck.
And then you can kind of feel what the easy joke is. You can feel that, and you know that's going to be said already. And then sometimes you come up with something that you think is original, but you're not quite sure, so you'll check Twitter then. You'll just type it in, or a version of it. You know, the two key points of the joke, you'll type both those words in. And if someone else has done it, usually it's 500 people have done it. You go, oh, no, I'm not the first one to think of that. I think plagiarism often happens by accident, especially with topical stuff, especially with Twitter. I mean, real-life people are so funny. And they're doctors on the side. I mean, they actually...
That's upsetting, isn't it? When you think of all the hours.
I could perform surgery.
So what do you think of as your strongest traits as a comic? What do you think your you mentioned superheroes before? What are your superpowers as a comedian?
I think that you need to have sustainability. I think you just have to be like what's the word? Durable? That's not the word though.
Consistent?
No, I'm not that. Just keep going, and
I don't mean in terms of advice. I mean specifically you.
I'm talking about me. I think that I'm fully prepared for the time that's coming very soon when I'm not on all the panel shows, and I'm fully prepared for the time that's coming soon that I won't be on tour and I won't have a new show, and there'll be some years that are quiet. And I think that as long as you keep writing, and what's the word? It's not durable. What's the word? Thanks, guys.
Resilient?
You see these people with real jobs who happen to be funny.
I can assure you these are all comedians.
Yeah, to be resilient. And I know that I've had times before that have been difficult, and those times are coming again, I know. And it's like a trade. If you can build a beautiful wooden table and you keep inventing and loving wooden tables and learning about building wooden tables, there's always going to be someone who wants a wooden table. Is that a good analogy or not? I think I love comedy. I'll always be working really hard. And that's why I have a job now. And hopefully that's why I always will have a job, even though that job is going to change.
Yes. I think actually that's very prescient. I think we can all see comics now who started 20 or 25 years ago, who caught the wave, who when comedy exploded for the first time in the UK.
Yeah.
They thought, hey, this is going to be fine. I mean, the case in point would be with the recent contraction of some of the commercial clubs in the UK, people who were making a very comfortable living and had been for 20 years, suddenly finding that their diaries were cut in half and their wages were cut in half. And I got the impression that no one was expecting that. And I get the impression now that we've all, as newish comics within the last 10 years, say, we've seen that happen in advance and gone, oh, right, I'd better, just as you said, I'd better be ready to tighten my belt. I'd better be ready to still remember I love the craft when the opportunities aren't there.
I'm almost looking forward to the time that I get to just be a little bit quiet and write maybe a sitcom or, God willing, I don't believe in God. I don't know why people say God willing. universe willing, a film where you have to take those quiet years. And you see people at the top of their game do it. You'll see Frankie Boyle, lots and lots and lots, and then he'll be quiet for a while, but he's written a book. My friend yes. Sarah Pascoe is not at the Edinburgh Fringe this year. She's writing a book.
Yeah.
And you have to, I mean, just resilience, I think. I've always been really resilient, and I've always had to really graft. I wasn't a waitress because I wanted to work at Hooters.
So what are your powers? What are your greatest kind of talents on stage, do you think? In the arsenal of a comedian, in which categories do you think, okay, well, that one, I'm better at that than I am at that?
I'm not great at crowd work or comparing. I think that's really difficult. I'm really terrible improviser. Oh, I went to an improv class and cried because it's really I really didn't like it. That was bullying. That was hard. But I think that I have a pretty good understanding for a joke that's going to work. And I think that helps me on stage. I'm pretty tight, or I try to be, with a lot of my material. I don't really storytell that much. And I think that, again, like you said, people know it does what it says on the tin. Mm-hmm. People kind of – and I'm lucky. I got into comedy – at a time that not a lot of women were on television doing comedy. And then I have this 10 years of experience all of a sudden when the industry is looking around for female comedians to put in all their stuff. And it's just the perfect time. It's like if you worked for Microsoft in the 80s.
Yeah, okay, that's an interesting analogy.
And all of a sudden the internet exploded and everybody got rich. It's like being a female comedian right now is really, really cool. And that's just luck. I'm just lucky.
And do you think at the moment, I feel like there are loads, at this festival particularly, just for example, there are so many brilliant female comics doing their first hours that you go, oh, there are going to be, it's going to completely change again in 5 years, where there will be enough of those people will have been here for a long time. Like almost like the youth of this world, the Sarah Pascoes, have inspired the next generation of female comedians.
Yeah, and you see them in your shows, and I've been to see some female comedians who are starting out at the festival already, and they're really, really great ones. You're right. I mean, it's that whole thing of I can't be what I can't see, and I had Sarah Milligan for that here, and it makes it more achievable. You go, oh, no, there is a chance. I can do that.
Just to stay with that idea of kind of strategy, you were saying of other comics kind of taking a year, changing it up. Do you say yes to everything you get offered on TV? Do you turn things down? And if you do, on what basis?
Oh, yeah, I do turn things down. I think I used to say yes. I felt like I was on call almost. It's that few years of residency where you have to just be busy, be on tour a lot, do lots of open mics and take everything that's offered to you. But I'm at the point now where I can say no to some things, and that's lovely because I'm on tour. I wasn't on tour when I was always saying yes. And I think that takes precedent over a lot of things. And you don't want people to get massively tired of your stupid face. You know, and there are some things that there are talking head shows that'll be like, oh, you know, the top 50 t-shirts of the 20th century. And I don't know it. That's not my area. So I can say no to it now.
Okay.
But you know those shows that I'm talking about?
Yeah.
I just can't. I don't know.
This is something I heard secondhand. I heard that Phil Jupiter has said this in the past. It's not a direct quote, but I'm sure he said something along the lines of if you want to be on TV, you have to be someone who's on TV. So you get, you've got to sort of say yes to everything for a while. Like the open mic circuit for TV. You're almost like a TV open micer.
But I wasn't saying yes to everything because I thought it would be good for me. I'm so excited to try Let's Dance for Comic Relief. I thought that was so cool to do a Nicki Minaj pastiche for charity. And I went on The Cube recently because I really wanted to, and I believe in the charity. And I love Mock the Week, and I love 810 Cats, and I want to do those things. I'm excited to do those things. So it would be hard for me to say no. If I do say no, it's usually difficult. And it's usually because I've taken one day off a week to hang out with Violet, who's my daughter. Did I say that before? Just, you know, Violet. because she does come on tour a lot and we see each other a lot. She usually is sleeping when I go to work.
Sure.
It's fine. But I need to also still be a mom and say no once in a while and be at home.
I just want to come back to something we were talking about earlier on. I remembered a secondary question I had, which is about the idea when you were saying that one of your strengths is that you've got a good sense of what's funny. So you go on kind of armed. You know that the stuff you're going to try is, you're very confident that the stuff you're going to try is going to work. Yeah. And I'm interested in just knowing whether there is an element of that being something that protects you. Because I would think of that. I've for years tried to have, you want to have a load of jokes in your back pocket, which are definitely going to work quickly in case you get in trouble, slam, and you know, everyone's back on side. And I wonder, for myself, I wonder whether that is kind of a type of defense mechanism that actually that's there so that I don't have to risk kind of opening myself up. And it's a very different type of comedian to either of us. I saw Tommy Tiernan earlier tonight, who's improvising an hour of stand-up.
Wow.
And in his words, it definitely happened. I just wonder what your feelings are on that, whether you think in, what are your feelings on maybe the idea of your material protecting you compared to sort of opening yourself to a gig and letting there be more possibility?
I think everybody's different. Every comedian has a different style. I don't think my material protects me. I think my material is my job. I don't think that people buy tickets to see me riff necessarily, whereas they would love to see Tommy Tiernan improvise. He's a wonderful improviser. I absolutely open myself up, but it's through material. I love jokes. And yeah, they don't always land. Not everybody likes everything I say. Of course not. But the jokes that I think are funny, I've written them not to protect myself, but that is myself. That's the job.
I suppose, thank you. I suppose what I'm getting at is just whether comparing you now to the 10-year-old who was being bullied and going, hey, this is totally fine.
Yeah.
Whether, like, if she'd had a pocket full of diamond one-liners, things might have been different.
No, they wouldn't have, because nobody would get it. They're so stupid.
I'll stop trying to bang that particular drum. Ladies and gentlemen, in the remaining moments of the show, do we have any questions? Would you agree with the concept of quotas for female comics? Is there a risk that's seen as tokenism?
Yeah, I've heard that argument, and you can make many arguments on both sides of it. I do think it's necessary to have the quota right now, but it was Ari Shaffir, who's an American comedian, who was chatting about this with me the other day, and he had a really interesting take on it. He said that when you do that, when you say there must be one, there must be always one, there is a danger, and that is that you'll not want to use the same established female comedians. And there are, at the minute, whether you like it or not, fewer established female comedians than male comedians. So you'll get someone who has less experience. You'll get a two-year comic, and you'll sandwich her in between 25-year male headliners. People see that show, go, oh, women are funny. Well, no, that's not about gender. That's about experience. So I think it's tricky, and I think there's no perfect answer. I do think we need something of a quota, but I don't know exactly. I don't have all the answers, or else I'd be like, the world's richest commissioner. But I don't know. I think it's kind of a necessary evil at the minute. It's not perfect, but I don't worry about being labeled as a token because I've been called much worse.
So is there a comedian for you that when you think about them, they inspire you? Is there a comedian that particularly, and why?
Ooh, there's so many, and they change all the time. I'm living at the Edinburgh Fringe now with Joe Lycett and Aisling B, who are just magnificent vegans.
Magnificent vegans.
Yeah. Wonderful. They're just good people, and they're good friends, and they are totally my people. I love comedians. I have not met a bad egg. Well, yeah, like three bad eggs. But I really love Daniel Sloss, who is from Edinburgh. He's always welcoming when people come in. I've always looked up to Frankie Boyle, and I know that he has been, criticized for lots of different things, not being a feminist. I think he is a feminist. He's a philanthropist. He's more and more political, and he's always on the right side. I love the way that he writes. I love him. I've always been inspired by him. When I was growing up, I loved Joan Rivers, and I loved Bette Midler, who I know is not a stand-up, but she's so cool. And I loved Sarah Silverman. I love Amy Schumer and everything that's happening with her right now. There's so many, and they change all the time. Stuart Francis is not like me. He's a very gifted one-liner comedian. My style is nothing like his, but he's always someone that I've looked up to. He's Canadian, and he came here long before I did and just really was embraced by the British public. I always am excited to hear his material. I like comedians that I'm excited to hear from. And those are usually the ones who write the most.
And what things do you see, without naming names or asking you to identify individuals, what things do you see that make you sigh in comedy? What things do you see where you go, oh, this is the opposite of inspiring?
I don't like it when, and maybe this is me becoming British, I don't like it when people don't leave room for you to be proud of them.
That is the most diplomatic thing I've ever heard.
You know,
is everyone on board with what Catherine means by that?
No.
It's be like, less diplomatic.
I love to see people do well, but it's just not cool in comedy or anywhere else to be like, look at me. Look at me. Look how well I'm doing. Look at this. Look at me. Because then there's no room for everyone else to say, oh, look at you. Well done. You know, we really love that. I don't like that. It really winds me up. And it's embarrassing. It makes me feel hot. I want good things for good people, but I want them to be like, have a little bit of decorum about it.
How does North America versus the UK relate in terms of the political correctness in the light of Seinfeld and Kumar's recent comments?
I love Seinfeld, and I know that that was not big over here, not as big as it was in North America. I watch that every day. Julia Louis-Dreyfus is someone else that I've always looked up to fiercely. I love her. I can't say enough about her. But again, I don't have that much experience on the circuit in Canada and in America, but in my brief experience, I think they are a little bit more politically correct in Canada, or not politically correct, because certainly America are not correct. America do. Yeah. They do horrible, horrible things every day. I don't know. But the television, I think it's fear more. There's a way of censorship that goes, oh, we can't say that. We don't want to. And I think Britain, for me, nails it better than anywhere else. I moved here, and right away, this wasn't my girlfriend or my boyfriend. This is my partner. And I thought, is everyone gay? I didn't know what it meant. Yeah. And I saw more different cultures mixing together and beautiful children. I think, God, I want my next kid to definitely be some Japanese. On the subject of political correctness, I want a Japanese one because... I love it. I think it's more evolved to have different cultures together and learning about one another. And that's very specific to London, which is such a beautiful melting pot of that. But in television, I've gotten away with a lot in television in Britain that I don't know that I could say. Certainly not in Canada. We had this garbage show in Canada on the CBC called Little Mosque on the Prairie.
Wow.
Yeah. And
that
it
is
was
just quintessential Charlie Brooker. Go on.
It felt like someone spitting in your face every time you watched it. And it was a series, and it was written by this lady who, to the best of my knowledge, was not a comedian, but she wrote this hilarious, very politically correct show, and it was so confusing and so weird, and that's the year I left.
Yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, that's all we've got time for. Please join me in thanking Catherine Ryan. So that was Catherine Ryan. Thank you so much for listening. Thanks to Catherine for coming on the show. Thanks to Nathan Wood for co-producing it. And that'll do us for now. More great live shows from the Edinburgh Festival coming out soon. And remember, it's Canonsgate. Get there at 4:25 for a 4:55 start, if you can possibly afford. Who's got that much free time at Edinburgh? But you can dive in, get a token, and then nip out and come back if you'd like. That's the show. That's the show for today. You can hear how giddy I am. I've just had some fizzy drinks, and I'm burning off calories like a good one. I think I've said everything I need to say. At ComComPod, info@comedianscomedian.com. Watch the website, comedianscomedian.com, for news on merch, and chuck us a donation if you see fit. Thanks for listening. I'll speak to you soon.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.